Here we go. I'm about to phone up Bobby Hart, the songwriter from Boyce and Hart, who wrote the Monkees theme and Last Train to Clarksville and all these amazing songs. I am dead nervous. Here we go. Oh, God. This guy's one of my heroes. It's an American ringtone.
Hello.
Hey, is that Bobby?
It is.
Hi,
how are
Bobby.
You?
It's Ian Lee. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Yourself?
I'm really good, man. Are you okay to talk for a little bit?
I'm good.
Hey, listen, thank you so much for coming on the line and coming on my show. I have to put my cards on the table. You and Tommy, together, kind of, you've written the soundtrack to my life. I am a huge Monkees fan, and I'm not just like, hey, I've got the greatest hits and Headquarters. I've got everything, you know. I've got the bootlegs and the everything, and you know, I knew I'm Not Your Stepping Stone when I was 5 years old. So, and I've got to tell you, I've got a little boy who's 2 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm educating him well. We were in the car yesterday, and he said, "Daddy, play the Monkey Around song." I thought, yes. That's it. The Monkees theme is what he was after. Listen, let's...
Yeah, you've corrupted another generation.
Well, how does... I mean, that song is like 45 years old. And,
that's right.
And kids are still digging it. And it still sounds, you know, it still sounds like a fresh song.
Yeah, I think some of the Monkee records do stand the test of time.
Listen, we'll get to the Monkees in a second. I want to know about you, first of all, sir. How did you get into songwriting?
Well, just kind of through the back door. I was raised in Phoenix, Arizona, and after high school, I came to Hollywood to seek my fortune. I always thought I was going to be a disc jockey.
Do people actually go to Hollywood to seek their fortune? Does that really happen? Because that just sounds like
that really happened.
Wow.
I went to attend the Don Martin School of Radio in Hollywood.
Brilliant.
And it wasn't long though before I got a job in a print shop, because I knew how to do that. So on the way to work, walking to work down Hollywood Boulevard, Vine Street actually, there was a small studio that had a marquee that said, "Come in and see what your voice sounds like, $10. And that kind of haunted me for a while, and I got up my nerve and went in and I made a little demo. And I was hooked. So I dropped out of disc jockey school. And my first manager, a guy that I was introduced to be a manager, he said, "Well, I like the stuff you're doing there, but I'm only interested in artists who write their own songs, have their own original material."
Yeah.
But go home and write some songs and come back. So just because he told me to do it, I did it, and ended up writing songs for 5 or 6 years before I ever had any success as an artist, although I was trying the whole time.
Going back into the first time you walked into the studio, do you remember what the very first song was that you recorded?
Yeah, I sat down at the piano, and I made a little Jerry Lee Lewis-esque track of "You Are My Sunshine."
Oh, beautiful. The classic.
And then I put my voice on it and some background parts, and I said, "Wow, that sounds great." And I was hooked. I was there every Saturday, spending more money than I was making, you know, in this little $10 an hour studio.
Do you remember what the very first song was that you wrote?
The first one that I wrote might have been a song called "Strange Change." I was making, I went in and I did like four rockabilly kind of things for this manager. And one was called "Becky Baby," because my high school sweetheart was named Becky.
I love it. And how did you, when did you get paired up with Tommy? How did that happen?
Well, it was right around the same time, actually. The Jesse Hodges, this manager who signed me then and produced my first record and got me on Radio Records. Also, his office was kind of like a melting pot for the up-and-coming talent around town. You'd see Donnie Brooks, you'd see Johnny Burnett and Dorsey Burnett in there, and Tommy would frequent that office, and that's where I met him, is in the manager's office. Well, actually, it's not true, but I would see him around there. But the first time we met, I was in a small studio where my friend John Mariscalco was doing a demo, and he had hired Tommy to sing the demo.
And how did you start writing? Because I always think it's odd. Songwriting partnerships strike me as odd. To me, it seems like a very solitary thing. You sit down with a guitar or a piano and you write some songs. How did you go, hey, do you know what? We should write something together. And then when did you realize that it kind of gelled?
It didn't start like that. We actually we became friends, and we were just hangout buddies. He was still living at home in the suburb of L.A. I had married my high school sweetheart, Becky, by then, and we lived in Hollywood. So he would come up on the weekends.
Yeah.
And we'd just hang. And so I was still writing my own songs. He was writing his own songs. But we would critique each other's songs and help help each other finish them up, but we wouldn't take writer's credit.
Right.
And we did that. I don't know if we ever wrote a song that we put each other's names on until after he got his break to go to New York and started writing for Dunes Records and had a couple of hits with Curtis Lee.
Mm.
And then I finally got a chance to go to New York after the breakup of my marriage. So this was like six years into our friendship.
Yeah.
And that's when we became partners in earnest.
And how did it work? Was one of you the words man and the other one would sit there with the guitar? Or
no, Tommy was always sitting there with the guitar because, later on we would go into these little cubicles that they would have at some of the publisher's office where there would be a piano.
Hmm.
But either I'd be behind the piano or he'd have the guitar. But no, we both wrote both because that's how we had written for 10 years before we became collaborators. We both wrote lyrics, we both wrote melodies. But later on, I kind of got pegged as more of a lyric guy for some reason because Lester Sill at Screen Gems, when we came back to California in 1965 and signed with Screen Gems as a music, Lester would try to break us up now and then and pair Tommy with a lyric writer and pair me with a music writer.
Yeah. And wait, do you remember the first time you heard one of your songs on the radio?
Yeah, I guess 59 or so, I got booked on this rockabilly. I had this record out called Stop Talking, Start Loving. It was a rockabilly song.
I love it.
and I got booked on this short rockabilly tour to Texas, and one of the stops was Midland, Odessa, Texas.
Yeah.
And I remember they had assigned me a driver. That's an interesting story because who the driver turned out to be. Anyway, he was driving me around, and the record came on the radio, and it was I was like busting, you know.
Fantastic.
And he said, "Oh yeah, they're playing your record." He thought I was a star because of how often they were playing the record in this little town because they were promoting the show.
Fantastic.
Anyway, that guy, that driver, and I didn't know this until years later, but. I was looking at a Roy Orbison Greatest Hits album, and I see his co-writer. He had a co-writer on most of his big hits, and his co-writer was named Joe Melson, and that's who that driver was.
Really?
Yeah.
And
before he had hooked up, I don't think he'd hooked up with Roy yet at that show.
Wow.
Roy was the opening act on that show. It's the first time I saw Roy Orbison.
Fantastic.
He was a local kid, and he sang a couple of Jerry Lee Lewis songs.
Superb. And how did you were working in the Brill Building, were you?
Well, when I got back to New York again and Tommy started and I started writing in earnest, the Brill Building, the whole music business at that time was housed in a couple of buildings,
right.
High rises. The Brill Building and then catacornered across the street was 1650 Broadway, and those two buildings had all of the music publishers. And I had been signed by Don Costa to his publishing company, and so I was writing more there. And Tommy would come into town. He was living with his girlfriend in Riverdale, New York, and he'd come into town. And we would work there sometimes, and sometimes he'd work in my little flop house room where I stayed. But we frequented the Brill Building because we would go there to visit publishers.
I love it. It sounds like such a romantic, you know, kind of wonderful age of just these buildings with songwriters. You go, I want a hit, right? Go to the third floor and see these guys. How did you get the Monkees gig?
Well, while we were working there, I was actually splitting my time between New York, writing with Tommy, and then I'd be on the road half of the year as a background singer for a guy named Teddy Randazzo, who played Vegas most of the time.
Right.
And during this one of the periods I was out of town, Tommy got a call from Donnie Kirshner, who had just sold his Nevins Kirshner music to Columbia Pictures, and he wanted to sign Tommy and send him out to the West Coast, which he did. And Tommy was coaxing me to get off the road and come join him. So I finally, about 6 months later, I joined him in Hollywood in '65, and. They had just opened the West Coast office. Nevins Kirshner or Screen Gems Music back east, of course, was big. They had all the big stable of writers like Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Manon Wild and all those people. But we were the new kids out in the California division. And so we were getting a lot of a lot of assignments for motion picture and television shows, and that was one of them. It was the Monkey Show. We went over to meet with the producers, and they told us what they had in mind and what they needed musically, and we thought it was tremendous, combining television with actual recording artists and radio.
It seems so obvious now, doesn't it? But at the time, it must have been revolutionary.
Well, we knew the template had worked with Ricky Nelson when he sang his first song on the Ozzy and Harriet show years ago.
Yeah.
And he became a giant star. You know?
Yeah.
So we knew the potential, and so we worked with him for nearly a year before the show was cast and it actually came on.
Was there ever any talk of you guys being in the show?
Well, Tommy always thought that we should have been considered, but I think by then they wanted to keep us writing.
Right.
And so I don't think that we were ever seriously considered. We did sit in on some of the auditions for the others.
Yeah. And the famous story about the Monkees theme is you were walking and you got the kind of walking rhythm. And that's how the song... It's as simple as that, is it?
Well, pretty much. That and the Dave Clark 5, which had a big hit at that moment called Catch Us If You Can.
Yeah.
It had that finger-snapping hi-hat, that thing going on. And we loved that little hi-hat thing. And so we were walking down the street to a park. We often rode outside because, you know, California weather and all.
Yeah, of course.
We'd go to the beach or we'd go to a park. So we were walking down to a park near the house at that pace and doing that sh-ch-ch-ch thing, and it just kind of came really quickly.
And it's mad because people who don't know your songs and people who don't even know the Monkees, everyone knows the Monkees theme. Even if they don't know any other song, everyone knows Here We Come Walking Down the Street.
Yeah.
Do you feel, this is going to sound silly, do you feel a weight of responsibility on your shoulders for having written such a huge song?
No, it's just, you know, we were doing, we kind of considered ourselves short order cooks. They'd give us assignments, and we would write them and demo them and get them back to whoever needed them in a day or two. That was just another
incredible.
One of those. We knew that we needed to work in certain lines about the... This was a network television show about four guys that didn't have any parental guidance.
Yeah.
They were on their own, and that was never heard of, you know, on the U.S. TV. And so we needed to make them seem non-threatening, so we had those lines about we're just trying to be friendly. And those. So there were certain attitudes that we knew we needed to work in.
Yeah.
And we wanted to make it fun and sing along, and we saw that as our job.
You produced the first album.
Yes.
And played on it, pretty much?
Yeah, we did an interesting thing. Tommy and I decided to use my band called the Candy Store Prophets. We were playing in clubs around town. And we knew these were great musicians.
Mm.
And rather than use the studio musicians that we would normally use and that everybody else was using, we said, you know, let's make this a real band. That, you know, I play in this band every night.
Mm.
And make it sound like it's a real cohesive group. And I think it really worked well on the first album.
I think it does on the first album, because the second album, where it's like, I don't know, six, seven different producers and different musicians and everything, it sounds like a load of different songs thrown together. But the first Monkees album, it's got that thread going all the way through it, that sound.
Right, yeah.
Can I ask, sir, what were you smoking when you wrote, I'm going to buy me a dog? What the hell were you thinking?
Well, we had written that. There'd been a couple of versions out before the Monkees.
Yeah.
It we'd written it for a guy named Gamaguchi. He's called the great Gamaguchi, the real Gamaguchi. I forget what he built himself as, but he was kind of a character. And we'd seen him in clubs and liked him. And he came to us with a song he had written, which we liked. So we produced him and we threw this on the back. We said, well, we'll do a novelty thing with him. So when we started looking to the pace, the first album, we knew we wanted to have a song like Yesterday, like the Beatles' Yesterday.
Yeah.
So we did the I Want to Be Free thing with the string quartet. We knew we wanted to have one token novelty song, like the Ringo song.
You wanted
right?
the Ringo song, yeah.
So when the guys came in to the studio, because we would get either Mickey or Davey, this is one time we had both of them together, after they had done maybe 12-hour shoots on their television show, so they were exhausted.
Yeah.
And we would have everything ready for them, just teach them the song quickly and you know, only keep them an hour or so. But when they came out on this one, they thought it was so stupid that they just started ad-libbing all that stuff on their own, and they're thinking that, you know, that's the first take, you'll never keep that. But we loved what they did, and that's how it came out.
It was brilliant, and it's kind of set the tone for some of their later albums with, you know, with Peter Percival and Band 6 right. and stuff like that, where it's them goofing off a bit, which is kind
right.
of... And also, you forget that bands these days, it takes them 3 or 4 years to make one album.
Yeah, it's true.
They did like 4 albums in a year, I guess, or something like that.
We did. It was crazy. Well, that was the norm at that time. And, you know, it was a lot different when you go into a three-hour session and you've got 4 songs. So you need three-hour sessions. You got an album because you do some sweetening and strings and horns and all. But it was a whole different process than tweaking the bass sound for 3 days, you know.
When did Boyce and Hart become a musical act in itself?
Well, it was after the second album where they decided to they pulled their coup and said, we want to take control of our music. We want to get our own producer. We want to write our own songs, whatever. And at that point, Tommy and I had been appearing in all the fan magazines as the guys behind the Monkees and all, so we had like a fan base already, and so we got an offer. We had a few offers, but we chose A&M Records. And it was interesting because Tommy and I had very divergent vocal styles. We both wanted to be artists. That's why we got into the business, but we never even considered doing it together because I was more into the black music, R&B sound, and he was more just bubblegum pop, or country. He was country influenced as well. But because we had our audience was now the Monkees audience, so we had to kind of tailor our sound to that audience.
I've got a wonderful DVD that someone sent me of you guys. I think it's on a show called Hollywood Palace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's either you or Tom, I think it's you, wearing the most beautiful red velvet suit.
That's right.
It's a work of art, and it's beautiful. I love 60s pop stars, and the song "I Wonder What She's Doing Tonight," which I don't think was a hit over in the UK.
Yeah, I don't know if we had hits. I'm not sure if we did in the UK.
But it's a cracking song. You know, it really is good. How long did that last? Because you only had a few hits as the two of you, didn't you?
We had 5 chart records in the States. That was our biggest one. Then we had another top 10 one called "You're Still My Favorite Girlfriend," Alice Long.
Yeah,
and then we had 3 others that were play somewhere in the top 100.
And then I guess the Monkees kind of comes to an end in. Oh, by the way, I have to say I disagree with Nesmith. Valerie is just a perfect 2.5 minutes of pure wonderful pop. That's the that's the song that made me go out and buy my first Monkees record when I heard that
really?
On the TV. Yeah,
wow.
It's like Valerie. It's like, man, this is because it's a bubblegum pop song, but
it is. Yeah,
it's got the class of the horns on it. It's got that amazing guitar solo.
Yeah,
that just gives
Louis Sheldon. Louis Sheldon. You know, we had cut that. We cut that right after we did the first album, and it was really sounding good. And then that was just before the Monkees pulled their power move.
Yeah.
And so the edict went out: we can't use any of this stuff in the can because it's not produced by the Monkees. So, cut to 3 years later, or 2.5 years later, whatever it was, and the Monkees had kind of run their course. Mm. Of course, Donnie Kirshner was out of the picture. Lester Sill was now taken over. And he said, you know, I don't have any... You know, these guys have been in the studio for months, and I have nothing that sounds like a hit to me. And I know Valerie is a hit, but I can't put it out. So he said, well, I want you guys to go back in the studio, re-record it note for note, don't take producer's credit.
Yeah.
And then that's what we did.
And the first version is superior, it's got to be said. You know, it's just got that little kick to it that the second one kind of lacks a bit.
Yeah, even Louis Sheldon always said that his flamenco guitar stuff was a little better on that first one.
And then what happens? The Monkees split up. Boyce and Hart, I guess you go your separate ways, do you?
Yeah, the Monkees, well, Boyce and Hart actually split up at the end of 1969,
right.
And the Monkees pretty much were petering out right after that, early 70.
Yeah.
So all kind of went apart at the same time.
And then what do you do? What do you do when you've been a huge pop star, you've been a huge songwriter, and then that kind of, that bubble sort of bursts? What happens?
Well, it was a little culture shock, but God has been good to me he's just put really great people in my life when I needed them. And it wasn't too many months before I heard from a guy named Danny Jansen, who had some hits with Bobby Sherman and others. Wanted to know if I would help him write some projects that he was doing. So we became partners for about 5 years. Pretty much, probably the most prolific writing time of my life. We were doing like averaging a song a week, writing and producing, because we produced everything that we wrote was coming out on somebody's record.
One of the great kind of forgotten projects, I think, is Dolenz Jones, Boyce and Hart. And I was listening to the studio album today and then live at, live in Japan.
Uh-huh.
That's a cracking little band that you had there. How did that come about?
We asked, how it came about is my friend Christian DeWalden came back from the Far East, I guess it's Southeast Asia, I should say, and he said that there's a promoter in Bangkok that wants to book the Monkees. Would you see if Mickey's up for it? So I called Mickey, and he said that he and Davey had been doing some shows, but they didn't know where Peter was, and Michael was not interested, and so I gave the news. So Christian came back with the idea, well, why don't you and Tommy go out with Peter and Davey? So the four of us met and decided, well, of course, if the offers are right, you know, we'd consider that. And so while we were waiting for this Southeast Asian tour, which was about a year and a half later, we started getting booked all through the States, mostly in amusement parks and so on.
But playing huge audiences, like 12, 15,000 audiences, weren't you?
Yeah, well, we didn't know what was going to happen. The first place we went was called Six Flags Over Mid-America near St. Louis. And I don't remember the figure, but it seems like there was like 23,000 kids showed up in the... Yeah, and so we knew there was still an audience 10 years after.
Yeah.
And it was fun because we didn't have to do much rehearsing. And I wanted to comment on the band that you just commented on. We asked our friend Keith Allison, who had been part of the Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Great guitarist.
Yes, and we asked him to put a band together and be our musical director, which he did. And he got Jerry Summers on drums and David Castle. We had a couple of... three keyboardists over the time that we toured, and a guy named Rick Tierney on the bass, and it was a great little band, and we really had a great time. We didn't have to rehearse because we knew the songs. We did Boyce and Hart songs, we did Monkey songs.
Yeah, you know all the tunes, all the stuff you wrote. And it is a cooking band. If people listen to Live in Japan, I've also got a very sneaky bootleg of Live in Disneyland.
Oh.
Where Peter gets up on stage at the end as well, which is...
Yeah, no, I've never heard that one.
Oh, have you not?
No,
I'll speak to Caroline. I'll send you a copy. It's a cracking record. And Peter gets up, and the band, you know, it's Monkees tunes, but they're a little bit dirtier with, you know, a real raunchy sound going on.
Yeah, that's Keith's influence with his rock guitar.
I guess the album didn't really take off, which is the thing. When it's got some wonderful songs on it, Sail on Sailor, I Remember the Feeling, which is another great lost single.
I think that should have been a hit, but we get signed by a guy named Al Corey, signed us to Capitol Records, and then just before our album was to come out, he went over to another label to RSO. And so there was nobody there in our corner, and
it's
just kind of
such
happened.
A good song, you know, perfect song. And the really, when I was about 15, I got hold of a copy of that weird TV special you guys did.
Oh yeah,
it's a lot of fun, but there's no audience there, is there? That audience is dubbed over.
No, yes, there's no audience.
I thought so.
And
okay.
Mickey directed.
Yeah, it's a wonderful show.
One of his first directorial. jobs. And,
it's Mickey's fro, and his very camp glam version of Stepping Stone is what makes it for me.
Yeah, no, there was some good parts in it.
Speaking of which,
his sister Coco played some of those little skits with us.
Was that Coco in it?
That's Coco, and then Davey, of course, choreographed a little hat and cane number.
Coco's, I've got to say, very cute.
Yes, she was.
How did you feel when you heard the Sex Pistols doing Stepping Stone? That must have been a culture shock.
It was a compliment. I enjoyed it very much.
It's
quite different. I met someone last night from a group called the Dickies. And they said that they had done a version of She, which I have to go and try online and see if I can.
And then let's skip forward a bit, because I've been keeping you for ages. So I could talk to you all night. I will come to an end in a minute. I promise you, Bobby.
That's fine.
You've been very patient.
No problem.
There was kind of a resurgence with the Monkees in the 80s, the huge resurgence. And
yes.
That must have affected you as well, because I think you and Tommy got back together, did you, for a bit?
Well, we were together for the Dolenz Jones Boyce, and I worked with Danny Jansen for first half of the 70s, and then Dolenz Jones Boyce and Hart came about. So we did that for 2 years, then Tommy and Mickey moved to England, and in the early 80s I teamed up with a guy named Dick Eastman. And so in 86, when this when they started touring and MTV started playing their shows, and they had found their whole new audience, and they were the highest grossing touring act of 86. Arista, who had fallen heir to the Monkees masters at that time, put out a best hits record, a best of, and included a couple new cuts. So Dick Eastman and I had a cut of a new song on that album. So I continued my run of having at least one song on every Monkees album.
I only found out today that you wrote Anytime, Anyplace, Anywhere.
Yeah.
I never knew that. I never looked at the label to see that. Yeah. It's another great song. It's got that 80s feel to it, but it's a cracking song.
And then Pulit came out, and I guess that was when Rhino bought the masters, and we had a Eastman and Hart song in that as well.
The Long Way Home.
Yes, that's right.
Again, one of the standout tracks. They didn't use a song of yours on Just Us. I thought, come on, guys, now that's a bit...
No, well, that's what it was all about. It was Just Us. They were going to produce and write everything.
And I think it's a cracking album, but I think it could have done with some outside songs just to give it that pop vibe. Do you know what I mean?
Well, don't tell Nesbitt.
I know. I would never dare tell Nesbitt. Do you see any of those guys at all? Do you speak to them?
I had the wonderful opportunity in July to say goodbye to David Jones.
I was going to ask if you spoke to David. Yeah.
Didn't know. Of course, I didn't know I was saying goodbye. But came home, and I hadn't planned to go to the Greek Theater, but there was a call from David's office asking, saying there'd be tickets for us. So we went down and went backstage. It was an unbelievable show. It was the best show they've ever done.
Oh, I saw them at the Royal Albert Hall last year. And
did you see it? Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. 35 songs. Wonderful.
Yeah. So I spent, my wife Marianne and I spent 15, 20 minutes talking to Davey in his dressing room afterwards, and it was just really nice reminiscing and not knowing that would be the last time I would see him.
If it's not too painful, can I ask, how did you hear about Davey's passing?
I actually got a telephone call around 9 or 10 in the morning from a friend of a friend, and then turned on the TV, and of course it was everywhere. We had a very nice celebration last night, about 50 people. Nesmith came. Mickey had arranged the whole thing. He did it very tastefully. And just a lot literally family, daughters and sons of all the Monkees were there. And Neil Sedaka came and sang the song that he had written, that Davey sang. And Engelbert Humperdinck, who happened to live next door, came over and he sang. It was just an unbelievable evening.
Well, you can't have it. You can't have everything you want, can you? Engelbert, stop it, please, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, it was a wonderful evening last night, and one I won't forget for a while.
They're my favorite band, and I was singing Daydream Believer to my little boy to try and get him to sleep when I got the text saying, that David passed, and it was
really
interestingly enough, there was a small kind of concert for Davey on Saturday that I compared, and they were raising money for MS and stuff. And it's very sad, but out of sadness I think does come a lot of joy and happiness, and it's a lot more people I think are aware of his work. And
that's true.
He's 66, man. That's no age at all. He was just a boy.
I know, and they supposedly in the best of health. And then just all over that quickly.
So sad. Are you still songwriting, sir, or have you put the pen and paper down now?
I put it down mostly. Once in a while, if I get an assignment, and that to write a lyric for a music composer who's doing a movie or something like that, but. I'm not doing much of that. I've been writing my autobiography for the last year or two.
How's that coming along? It's
coming great. I think that it's finished. We're just starting now, my co-writer and I, to look around for literary agents and see what we have to do next. But we've got our first draft done, and I think we're in pretty good shape.
Beautiful. I look forward to reading that. And two more quick questions, and I'll let you go. I will definitely let you go. Is there any unreleased kind of Dolenz, Jones, Boyce & Hart stuff in the vaults, or was that it? That album was everything.
No, I think that was it. And the album you told the bootleg you told me about is interesting because there might, I don't know how good it sounds, but
It's a little bit dodgy, but it's, yeah. I've got two bootlegs. I'll get in touch with Caroline, sir, and I'll make sure you get those in the next couple of weeks. I spoke to Peter a couple of weeks ago, and he's asked me to do a bootleg bunch of CDs as well. So,
oh, great.
Happy to sort you out. And
Peter,
I got,
Peter was there last night as well. I didn't mention him.
Really?
He flew in as well, yeah.
Oh, bless. You know, it's the saddest thing. I had an email. Let me just try and find this. Where has this gone? I had an email from Lola, I think it was. I think this is the perfect way to end the conversation.
Yeah.
Can you pick out the one song that you've written that you think is just the best, you'll be happy to leave behind?
You know, it's really hard. And you've heard it said before, they're like your children, and you can't be partial. But, of course, you are. But every song that you write, when you finish it, you think, oh, this is great. This is one greatest song I ever wrote, you know. And there's so many elements that come into finding out if that song is even ever going to be heard by anybody. So there's songs that I've written that I think are great that nobody has ever heard, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess I Want to Be Free has probably been covered more by other artists than any other song that we've written, and I think that was a good one because it's one of the only songs that Tommy and I ever wrote just because we felt like it wasn't an assignment or we didn't have a deadline or something like that. Just home, he and I bunked together we had shared a house.
Hey, it was the 60s, anything went.
In the 60s. And so I just came up one night, and he was sitting with his guitar playing with this idea. He had been playing over and over a Roger Miller record called One Dying and a Burying.
Okay.
And the last line of the song was, I Want to Be Free. About a guy who said, all I have to do to be free is to die and get buried. You know, it was kind of a morbid song.
Yeah.
He said, I got this new melody to go with that line, but I don't know where to go with it. And so I sat with him for a while, and it came very quickly. And we had that in our drawer when the Monkees Project came along a few months later.
That question was from Laura. Listen, Bobby, I could, you know, I've kept you for ages. I could literally talk to you for hours on
it. It's all right. Let me see what time it is. Yeah, we can do whatever you want.
Don't worry. Listen, I'm gonna let you go because I'm going to start getting really geeky and interesting only myself. But I just want to say, man, thank you so much for writing the songs. And, you know, it's very rarely that people... I think it's very rare that songwriters actually get thanked for what they're doing because they're quite often in the background. And...
It's true.
You've just, you know, you've made... I was reading on the internet that you've been responsible for about 85 million record sales. So that's well done. That's not bad, is it?
Not too bad. And
not too shabby.
I feel that the pleasure has really been mine and that I've been just very lucky and to work with some wonderful people and just be in the right place at the right time. And maybe also to have been unsuccessful for at least 6 or 7 years before having any success, which gave both Tommy and I some time to hone our craft a little bit, a luxury that so many of the young artists don't have these days. They're thrown into the spotlight. They're expected to write, to produce, to sing, and to dance. And, you know, so we were able to work at it for a little while, and it paid off when the opportunities came.
Bobby, God bless you, sir. Thank you so much. I wish you a long and happy life, and thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you. It's a wonderful interview, and I must say that you really know your Monkees stuff, and it was paced so well so that when the next question came, it was the perfect timing for chronologically for me to tell you my next story.
Listen, what I'll do is I'll send you a copy of this. I've got the Disneyland bootleg. It's not brilliant quality, but I'll burn you a CD, and I'll get in touch with Caroline and get an address to send it to, and I'll make
sure you get
that.
All right, Ian, thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.